Hello, Dr. Lear. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's nice to be with you, Ken.
Thank you. The first question I want to ask you is, the first time an implant showed up on an X-ray, did you know it was an alien implant?
Absolutely not. I started out really as a consummate skeptic, and had decided to offer my services to prove that this was all a big bag of nonsense.
Oh, that's interesting. Are there other doctors in this country or in other countries that you know of that have had similar experiences? I mean, they've found implants in people?
Well, not that I know of, but nobody really started to look at anything of that nature until I started doing it. Now I have people that suspect that something, they might have something unusual, so they contact me. I get around about 400 or 500 emails behind a week. So,
are most of all of the implants that you find located in the same area of the body?
Well, the one commonality of the ones that we've removed, and we've done 13 cases so far, and we're about to do another one this coming Saturday, is that they are in areas that if you had to put something in the body, you would have easy accessibility and would take very little time to do it. So I haven't found anything within deep body cavities such as the abdomen or the thorax or within the brain or anything, but they're all either in arms, feet, legs, hands, one we did below the jaw, one back of the neck. So they're all places, excuse me, they're all places that are really easy to get something in.
Ah, do these implants all look similar?
Well, we have several categories. We have those that I have synthetically divided into ones that are metallic, ones that are non-metallic, and one that's was totally biological. And we have five of the metallic group now that look exactly the same. If I laid them all out on surgical sponges, you wouldn't be able to tell which one came from who.
Have any implants that you know have turned up during autopsies?
Well, I really don't know. I have a suspicion that there are people that have passed away with implants. I have one of the first cases I did, I saw x-rays of the mother who had a similar object in the toe as what we removed from the daughter, but she was deceased and long gone. So, you know, and probably unless there was somebody wanted one done, they usually don't do autopsies.
Yes, I realize that. Now, I was just thinking, you know, during when people die and they don't know the cause, they usually do an autopsy. There must be millions of these autopsies going on in the country during a year, you know.
Probably, but when you're looking at the body and you're a coroner, you're really not going to X-ray like you do on CSI Miami or New York. X-ray every aspect of the body. You're usually looking for the cause of death, so that might lead you to the brain or the abdomen or lungs or something. But usually, you're not going to go peering through extremities unless it's maybe some kind of a criminal case.
Right. Well, it seems that the U.S. government has shown some interest in this. Am I correct?
Oh, yes.
Could you tell me, how does Colonel John Alexander fit into all of this?
Well, my association with Colonel John Alexander came about when he was on the science board of the National Institute for Discovery Science. And they were, fortunately, that's an organization which was a nonprofit organization set up by Robert Bigelow of Nevada. And it was a organization which looked into the scientific aspects of ufology and the mind. And what we, he first started to help me with some of the research and getting metallurgical data, I met John and some of his other colleagues. So he was very much interested. John Alexander has a double PhD and a very learned individual. And he was responsible, at least by saying okay to the expenditure of the funds to get me some of the analysis done.
I see. Has the government ever tested any of these implants?
I don't know what the government has done, but I've been in black budget laboratories, and the scientists that were looking at this stuff and crowded into a small room with the lab director standing out in the hall with his hands on his hips was not very happy that they were spending government money and government time looking at something that I brought in. But, you know, obviously there was something so interesting there that they couldn't help but, you know, want to learn more about it.
Well, these people that come to you, are they all convinced when they come to you that they have been abducted at one time or another, or do some of them come to you with a complaint that there's something under their skin that's bothering them?
Well, I get both individuals get in touch with me that do have something that they know is inside, and of course we have a very strict set of criteria and protocols for doing these procedures, which I had to set up. We formed a nonprofit organization which is called ANS Research, and they must conform to the protocols. Now, it's not just to have an object or a known object that's provable to us, but we have to have some indication that they've had some relationship to the ufology phenomena, either a prolonged sighting or memory or dream or something. And then usually we do not let them undergo any hypnotic regressions prior to the time the surgery is done. If they want to have it done afterwards, that's fine. But we don't try to enhance memory just because we don't want the criticism. But they have to have some relationship to ufology before they can even begin to become a suspected candidate for one of these procedures.
I see. So in other words, you've never operated on anybody and found that they had one of these in them just by mistake, in other words?
No. Okay. But, you know, I've removed hundreds, if not thousands, of foreign bodies in 43 years. Who knows what I removed and sent to pathology that they threw away. I mean, the obvious thing is, did you get it all? Is it out? Are the surrounding tissues normal? Is there any, the malignancies or anything in the area? And you don't really pay too much attention to what it is that you removed.
Have you ever heard of any of these implants being in animals?
No.
Okay. Could you tell my readers, how do these things link up to the body once they're put in?
Well, what we find anatomically is the metal is surrounded by a biological tissue. And that biological tissue we see on the electron microscope actually penetrates the metal, again, which is a portion of science which we really don't know how to do.
Mm.
That's one of the things. Next thing is that this biological tissue is then surrounded in normal tissue areas with abnormal amounts of nerve endings. Excuse me. These nerve endings are not supposed to be there, so it could be they could act as an energy source. Before removal of these objects, we test for electromagnetic fields, and we find that in most of them there's electromagnetic fields representing 4 to 6 milligauss, which is a pretty good magnetic field. And then on 2 or 3 of them now, we've been able to detect a radio frequency. So they are a functional object, and we believe that they use a form of advanced nanotechnology to function.
Do you think that what they're doing is magnifying the body's electrical field, or that they're supplying their own electrical field?
Well, I think that it's a mating of the biological energy in which we have in our body. Certainly neural energy has been captured by UCLA to... in a device to convert it into electrical energy so that it can operate servo motors and prosthetics. Therefore, a very sophisticated, expensive prosthetic hand has these little servo motors that move the fingers. Well, the interim or the interface for that is a device which actually takes the neurological energy coming from the nerve supply and converts it to electrical energy to operate these tiny little servo motors. So we know that the body has its own energy supply, and then when we look at these objects and remove them, they become inactive except for their magnetic field, which many times decays in a period of maybe 2 to 3 weeks.
Mm. What, if anything, have you noticed about these objects that lead you to suspect that they're alien and not advanced human technology?
Well, that's a very good question, Ken, and I'm so glad you asked it, because that's the major principle here, which we find most astonishing. When we look at the metallurgical portions, we find certain anomalies. Number one, as I said, they're highly magnetic, and you would suspect that something that is metal and is highly magnetic would contain what?
Oh, you're talking to me? Sorry. I thought you were continuing your answer.
No, something that's magnetic usually contains what?
Well, I guess metal.
Well, what kind of metal would you say?
Iron, steel, right.
So we do find iron, and yet when we look at the iron, we find that the iron is without crystalline structure. In other words, it's what we call amorphous. Now, the question being is, how do you get amorphous metals to be magnetic? That's one of the things which is like a monopole, which is highly, almost impossible to do. Now, I did find out in my travels that Black Budget Labs know how to make amorphous metals. As to what they use them for, I haven't a clue. But they don't know how to make them magnetic. So that's one of the anomalies.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the next one is the most telling. When we look at the isotopic ratios of some of the metals, we find they're non-terrestrial.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty good indication that these metals did not come from here. Not saying that if you wanted to spend a lot of money, you couldn't go to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and get all the non-terrestrial isotopes you want, and then spend millions of dollars to put them together. But you know, who's going to do that, to put a little 1 centimeter rod in somebody's hand?
You know, you read my mind, because you know what my next question was? There's a theory going around the internet that the implants are made from meteorites, and they were made this way on purpose by powers unknown to fool us, you know? And I was going to ask you what you thought of that theory.
Well, I think it's fairly ridiculous. In the first place, if we look at the amount of the population who has, interest in ufology, that write books or research, it's a very, very tiny slice of the pie. If you look at the amount of people who believe that in the United States that Roswell was an event, well, now we're talking about 92% of the mm-hmm. population. If you're looking at the polls that show how people think that the government might be lying as to what we know about the ET, why, again, you're up about the 78% range. But to have a purposeful event occur by somebody's skullduggery to fool a handful of researchers and spend millions of dollars to do it is certainly not economical.
Right. With these implants, I have read that one of the things about them is they can be implanted in a human body and there's no reaction to them. The body doesn't reject them in any way.
That's absolutely correct. When we look at the tissue surrounding where the objects are, we find that there's absolutely no rejection or inflammatory reaction whatsoever. And as you may have heard recently, our best attempt at putting implants in animals and humans especially came out with quite a piece on the news here about a month ago that they cause cancer.
Mm.
And so, if you want to put a chip in your dog, you can put a chip in a dog, but, that area is probably going to become cancerous. And if you certainly put one in your child, that's what you're going to find. So the best of our technology, we're not there yet.
Have you found that this membrane that is formed around this device mimics the tissue around it? In other words, it becomes composed of the same type of tissue?
No, it's not the same type of tissue, but it does apparently act as an interface between the metal and the surrounding tissue. I can tell you what this membrane or soft tissue is composed of. What's called a protein coagulum, which means that it's just proteins derived from clotted blood. And then we look at that like a bowl of Jell-O, and then we add a couple of things to it, which is some dark brown granules of hemosiderin. Now, hemosiderin is a pigment very similar to the hemoglobin, which is in your red cells. And it's an oxygen-binding pigment, so the hemosiderin is there to oxygenate the membrane or the tissue. And then we find what we call striated keratin, which composes the outer layer of our body and our hair and fingernails and so on. Well, those are the only three things that compose this membrane. Now, we haven't done any further studies because the funds have not been there to do it, just to look at things on a more molecular level or even to do DNA studies. Now, wouldn't it knock you on your bean to find out that the membrane is not the same DNA as the host?
Yeah, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you'd think, knowing this much, that we would be able to duplicate it, wouldn't you?
Yes, and I've wanted to get a research grant for around 501c3 so that we could do this on a medical basis, because if you were able to duplicate this membrane, my God, you could wrap a heart or a pin or a screw or a kidney or anything else on it.
Yeah, that's just what I was thinking.
And the patient would not have to take any expensive anti-rejection medication for the rest of their life.
Well, this could be some incredible discovery.
Right, but to try and get anybody to bite to do it or to put up the funds, it's almost impossible.
That's too bad. Do you think that these objects are some sort of tracking objects to allow people to be tracked?
No, I don't, because I would think that on the basis of, let's say, astrophysicist Michio Kaku's development of his theory about advanced civilizations, class 1, 2, and 3, even a class 1 civilization probably would be able, for example, if we know that DNA has its own electronic signature, so all you have to do is build a device that's sensitive enough to track your DNA, and they could track you wherever they wanted to, even a fly or an insect of some other type, anywhere on this planet or maybe the solar system or the universe, who knows.
So we really don't know what these things do. Okay.
Well, again, I can theorize legitimately, scientifically, and I think that one of the things, and I don't have all the answers, and if anyone says they do, well, you better put your fingers in your ears and run. But I think one of the things that's pretty common to the abduction phenomena is something that has to do with the taking of ova and sperm. So there's some genetic thing that seems to be going on, and it's perhaps indicates that maybe a portion or all of the human race is being genetically remanipulated into something else in which we're not. And this is quite evident in the children who have been born within the last 50 or 75 years. They're very different individuals, and it has nothing to do with TV or pollution or food. They can do some very unexplainable things, and I've done a study on 17 functional growth characteristics, and they've been accelerated from 16 to 80%, so that's a pretty short time for that kind of evolutionary leap.
Yes, it is.
So maybe these devices, going back to your question, maybe these devices sort of help them track a small sampling of the genetically manipulated population.
Well, you know, it's funny, because if you go back about 6,000 or 7,000 years, all of a sudden there was a leap by the human race in technology. And for the time before that, it was pretty much spears and rocks for hundreds of thousands of years. Do you think that maybe this is the second time around for this kind of thing?
It may be the second time around for us, but for others, civilizations, I believe, have come and gone, come and gone, come and gone. Now, when I say gone, we don't know whether they packed up and left, or whether they were the results of some natural disaster, but, you know, from looking at all the artifacts, you know, through history, we find some very strange advanced things. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. It was almost as if someone came around the time of Neanderthal, which Zacharias Sitchin says did happen, according to the Sumerian tablets, and manipulated, genetically manipulated what was there, which was obviously Neanderthal, and produced Homo sapiens. But, you know, the archaeologists now are finding Homo sapien prints walking, you know, alongside Neanderthal. So we couldn't be a descendant of Neanderthal. So it looks like, you know, we may have had some external origins.
Yes, it does. What do you do with the objects after they're removed?
Well, they, depending upon the amount of funds we have in the coffers, they're sent out first for biological testing, and then we send the metal portions out, and then the knowledge is accumulated, and once it's accumulated, it's given to the public freely. I've written seven books,
mm-hmm.
I've written on, I've been on numerous radio and television programs, and I've lectured in 42 countries in 7 years, so
wow.
We don't.
Well, tell us the names of some of the books that my readers, they may be interested in buying them, you know?
Well, some of the latest ones are UFO Crash in Brazil, which has absolutely nothing to do with implants, but it's my personal scientific investigation of a crash there that occurred in 1996, very similar to the Roswell event. And it's detailed, and there's an interview with an orthopedic surgeon, which I did, who was forced by the Brazilian Army to operate on a non-human being for repair of a fracture. That's one of the books. And then the next newest one is the Aliens and the Scalpel, second revised edition, which brings people up to date on the implant subject through about the 12th surgery. It's got pictures and scientific data in the back of the book. And then we have another one that I wrote. It's called Chopped Liver. It's put out by the California Book Publicists Association. It's an anthology. 52 different authors all telling true stories, and I have one in there. And then we have, I've got some DVDs that are out, the scientific study of alien implants, the one, the research of Dr. Lear, then there's a Dr. Lear story. So there's a number of different ones out there.
Very good. Have you yourself ever had any experiences that you couldn't explain?
Well, I've had sightings of something three times, which fall within the UFO category. I had an interesting experience attending a conference in Lawful, Nevada, which we, with about 40 witnesses, watched two stars move and come together, and my daughter and wife were with me, and we all seemed to get the same message at the same time, and that was basically, in short terms, hello, we're real, you've seen us, cheerio. And the crowd was so silent that you could hear a pin drop. Now, you know, I would think the normal psychological reaction to seeing stars move is to, you know, look and mutter something or yell, or, you know, the sky is falling or something. But here this group is so quiet, you can hear a pin drop.
That's amazing. Could you tell us about the research being done on this claw that was found? The research, I believe, is being done by the National Institute for Discovery Science.
Yeah, part of it was being done by them, and part of it was done through ANS Research, and we used a geneticist in Australia to look at some of the stuff. We did a lot of biological studies prior to trying doing DNA analysis, and we were left with a lot of mysteries. we were getting ready to print. This shows you how events happen. We were getting ready to write and print an article on a small genetic journal talking about the unusual nature of the DNA. We were not going to say anything about the non-terrestrial DNA, but we were going to just talk about the principles of the DNA structure that we found. And 2 weeks prior to the time that this was going to be published, the geneticist we were using discovered a new PCR technique. And from that, we found out that it was not a claw at all, but it was a slug.
Really? Wow.
Now, you think, well, gee, you know, that sort of invalidates all the work that was done, but it didn't, because the DNA on the slug showed that it had a 97% chance of being a slug from New Zealand and a 93% chance of being a sea slug. So the question remains, number one, is how did a sea slug from New Zealand get into this guy's closet?
What was it, petrified?
What?
It was like that, petrified.
You must be reading my mind. It was. It was petrified.
Uh-huh.
And I went to see a gastropodologist at the Natural History Museum here in Los Angeles. And I said, what happens when slugs die and dry up? And he says, well, they just, you know, get to be kind of leather-like and dry up and so on. I said, well, are you sure? And he says, well, yeah, I'm pretty sure. So we went back to Bakersfield, and we gathered up some local slugs, and we put them out in the sun. And what they did was virtually turn to powder and blow away.
Really?
Huh. This thing was so tough that you had a hard time cutting through it, even with a scalpel.
Wow. Well, maybe it was under the ground for a few years.
Well, if it was, then, you know, we would have gotten all sorts of contaminants that would have shown up in the DNA PCR test. Mm-hmm. So it evidently wasn't. Mm-hmm. But is this, you know, begs the question, is this some entity's sense of humor? You know, to plant a thing like this in the closet of an abductee so that they can sit around and laugh about it?
It is very strange, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, how did a sea slug from New Zealand get petrified into this guy's closet? Well, again, back to the National Institute for Discovery Science, when they had the ranch and they were looking at all the phenomena going on, they set up some very expensive experiments. And they had things happen there, which along the same lines, you know, there were wires cut that were inside steel poles, and the poles were not cut; only the wires were cut. And other phenomena occurred. It was almost like somebody with a sense of humor was laughing at their efforts.
Yeah. What do you think that aliens would use a scoop type instrument to dig out a hole in somebody's skin to use the to put the implant in with, when it seems like such a crude method, you know?
Well, again, all this is theory and conjecture, but there is some rationale. And remember I told you that one of the ingredients of this membrane was keratin?
Yes.
Well, perhaps there is a device that will scoop keratin out of the skin, and that can be used for the purpose of combining it with these other two ingredients to make this membrane. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not a place, really, where an implant is purposely injected. Now, we know that the areas of scoop marks have been subject to what we call solar elastosis. It means that a tiny little portion of the skin has been subjected to a high degree of ultraviolet radiation. How can this possibly be when you take a housewife who has, you know, milky white legs, doesn't sit out in the sun, and all of a sudden she gets one little scoop mark, and then it's been subjected to high amounts of ultraviolet?
Yeah, it's the first time hearing of that. That's amazing, yeah. Could you tell us why you decided to join forces with Dr. Philip Duke, and how do you think his specialties will be of help to you?
Well, I think Philip Duke has come up with some interesting ideas in relation to the immune system and the effects of some of these things on the immunological system. And He's basically scientifically oriented, and so I allowed him to use my website to sort of put his wares out to the public.
Well, I couldn't help but notice that Dr. Duke specializes not only in cattle mutilations and human abductions, but also in HIV and AIDS research. Does he think that there's a connection with AIDS and aliens?
I don't know if he's put AIDS and aliens together, but he certainly has put together the origin of the AIDS virus. And to make it quite simple, it's not something that can occur in nature.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he explains the origin of the virus and how the virus particles are put together, like a sheep virus combined with a human retrovirus is not something, that's like meeting a cat and a dog.
Right, so then there's only two choices. I see what you're saying. Either we created it or some other entity did.
Yeah, or, it's possible, again, I don't deny this, that we are constantly bombarded from outer space with microorganisms of all sorts, both bacteria and viruses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we may discover, something new every once in a while that's affecting the human race. Even the panspermia theory of the origin of mankind, may be possible. I can't say that's not possible. So, sure, there's a lot of stuff out there that doesn't necessarily have to be man-made, but we're so suspicious of the organization of some scientific groups around the world that, those are suspicions that one has to have.
Well, technology is always improving. Have you noticed any, improvement in any of these implants over the years?
Well, that's, again, an interesting question, because you don't know with the stuff that we take out. Maybe they're the Model Ts, and there's some new stuff they're using which you can't even detect on an X-ray or a CAT scan or an MRI that may be highly more sophisticated that we're not looking at.
That's what I was wondering about, yeah.
So it's very, possible. I mean, people see things in the sky. Some people see, the typical flying saucer, two inverted pie tins with a copula. Others see triangles, others see diamond-shaped objects. There's a whole plethora of the things that people see. Well, just because, Sam comes from one galaxy or a dimension doesn't mean that George comes from the same one.
Well, was there anything that you saw to indicate to you that maybe all of these implants do not come from the same place? I mean, from the same race or whatever.
Yes, and that's, basically the technology that's involved. I mean, we have three little grayish-white balls in three different individuals. Well, maybe they're the same guys that put them in. And then, as I said, we have five of these little metallic rods. Well, maybe it's another group that put them in. And then we have one that was biological, totally biological, that I've never seen before. And it was most unusual. So maybe we just, got another group that's using that one for something else.
Have you ever found any of these implants that are not attached to nerves?
Yes, the biological one wasn't attached to anything.
Oh.
In fact, we had a hard time getting it out because it would move away from you.
Really?
Yes, and I have this on video, and every time I watch it, it's hard to believe, but it took four hands to trap this thing and get it out.
Wow. Well, I have to ask this next question. Do you think there's any intelligence in that object?
Well, if you would touch the lady's arm prior to the time we did the surgery, and you touch the object and it moves away from your finger, and then after associating with your finger for a while, if you put your finger on an arm on her arm, it would start to follow your finger. Is that intelligence?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah. Well, let's see. Oh, I want to talk to you about the object from Roswell. I found that very interesting. Could you tell us about the object you have from Roswell and how you know that it isn't from the Earth?
Well, we've acquired an object from a friend of mine who is a researcher and research and development of engines and was himself a metallurgist. And he knew my interest in the ufology subject, so he presented this object to me and said that he had lent $35,000 on it to the person that gave it to him. That person picked it up from one of the Roswell crash sites. Now, there's more than one, and we don't know which one.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say this, that everybody associated with this object is dead or has come to a very bad end. Now, even the scientist that did the preliminary work on it, and it was composed of a number of different elements, and we found out that the major element, which was the silicon, had extraterrestrial isotopic ratios, and four other of the minor elements also had extraterrestrial isotopic ratios. And this was done by a multitude of laboratories. So the chain of evidence from my friend to me to the labs is all there, and the link, and the wife of the deceased person who gave it to me knew the individual that gave it to her husband for collateral for a loan. So, there's no eyewitnesses to say that this guy, picked it up somewhere else, but it's a very interesting object.
Well, it sounds like somebody is trying to stop you from publicizing it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does.
Mm. How do you feel about holding it?
Well, I try not to have it. I send it out, and there's a methodology for finding it and getting it, but if someone would torture me or give me a lie detector test, I would legitimately not know where it is.
Well, that's good. Do you think that the object itself might be dangerous and it's just not detectable?
No. I've handled it, and I'm fine.
Mm. Let's see, just give me one second if you would. Have you ever found more than one implant in a person?
Yes, the first case we did had two in the big toe.
One
on one side, one on the other.
Why do you think there'd be more than one? What do you think the reason would be for that?
I think we sort of touched on that. The patient was older. The implant had been there for many, many, many years. And perhaps it took two devices to perform a function.
I see. In other words, you feel that the original one was there so long it wasn't functioning properly any longer.
No. I just think that, a two-piece radio set may have been a precursor to a one-piece.
Mm. What do you think the objects are usually on the left side of the body?
Well, that's sort of gone out the window because now we've found them also on the right side. So it's very difficult to make conclusions based on a limited number of cases. And as we go on, we can learn more and make more conclusions.
Why do you think the implants fluoresce?
Don't know. There's something about them that does make them fluoresce, whether they are contaminated by something that makes them fluoresce. We know that certain abductees will come back with marks on their bodies, look like fingerprints or whatever, where they've been touched by non-terrestrial entities, and those marks fluoresce. Maybe it's something that's on the skin of these entities that cause fluorescence. Maybe that fluorescence is then carried to an object that they're placing within the human body. I don't know. It's a real mystery.
Have these objects ever been tested spectrally? I mean, with a spectrometer?
Oh, yes.
And was there any results that were unusual?
No, because there's many different spectrographic analysis tests, like FTIR, for example, and they're all used for a specific purpose, and that's part of the data that we collect. But you can't say whether it's usual or unusual. I mean, if you do an SEM and you find iron, is that unusual? No. But when we look at the X-ray diffraction on the iron, that is unusual.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how you found out that the people that were implanted needed more salt. And what do you think this was? Do you think it had something to do with the electricity in the body?
Yes, and that's a very good question. It's not just the people with implants. It's abductees across the board following an abduction will have all the symptoms of acute dehydration and ultimate craving for salt. And I think it's there may be some electrolyte depletion either due to the mechanism for getting them abducted or something else that's going on within the body. We started to do electrolyte analysis on some of these cases, and one of the most common symptoms you hear is acute dehydration following an abduction episode. So it's not just implant victims, it's also abductees straight across the board.
Well, that's interesting because that is not common knowledge.
No, and certain things are not for the purpose, the same purpose that Bud Hopkins gives. You're not putting, you know, everything out in the books because we want some of the data to remain, you know, sort of classified so we can sift out those that think they're an abductee from those that are not.
Well, I understand. In relation to these objects, what is the biggest one you've ever taken out and what is the smallest one?
The biggest one probably was the T-shaped object, which was about a centimeter in each direction. The smallest one was probably about 4 millimeters.
Hmm. Well, that was actually the last question I had for you during this interview, but I would like you to tell my audience anything you think that I missed that is, you know, interesting that they might enjoy hearing about.
Well, I think one of the things they might enjoy hearing is if there's someone that's listening out there that thinks they may be a victim or subject of this phenomena, what do you do? If you think you have a lump or a bump or something is bothering you and you don't know how it got there because you didn't have it the night before you went to bed, and you're interested in pursuing it, and I stress that highly, if you're interested in pursuing it, then you should simply go somewhere and get an x-ray taken and have it looked at. And if there's something there that shows on the x-ray, by all means contact myself or Bud Hopkins or someone else that's involved in the subject.
Well, that was the end of the interview, and I want to tell you, I really enjoyed it. You know, I learned a lot from this myself, I have to tell you the truth. Maybe someday we could get together again when you come out with a book or something. I'd be very glad to interview you.
Well, sure, I'd be very happy to.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Ken.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.